It's one small step for man.
There is no planet B.
I stand here today humbled.
You turn if you want to.
I will not be lectured about sexism.
The winner is Cindy.
This week in history.
If any of you have visited India, particularly the Punjab area, which is up in the northwestern part of India bordering Pakistan, you might have visited a city called Amritsar. You might have gone to a beautiful building there called the Golden Temple. Now, just next to this temple, there's a garden called the Jallianwala Bagh Garden. On April the 13th, 1919, a large crowd gathered in this garden, and they were protesting against British plans to crack down on independence movements in India. Not liking this, the brigadier who was in charge of the British Indian Army in the region surrounded this garden, blocked off the exits, and began firing on the protesters. And the army troops ended up killing somewhere between 379 and 1,500 people that day. It's a shocking part of the history of the British in India. It's something that back in 2019, on the 100th anniversary, the British government expressed regret over, but has never formally apologised for. Now, to tell you the story, my guest in This Week in History is Associate Professor Meera Ashar, who's Director of the Australian National University's South Asia Research Unit. Hello, Meera. Welcome to Nightlife.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
So tell us about the Punjab area in 1919, Meera, because I understand it was relatively new to being under British control.
It's one of the last territories to be to fall under British control, just before the 1857 mutiny. It was the sort of glorious Punjab Empire, which had managed to hold back British East India Company rule for the longest time. It was after the death of Ranjit Singh that chaos sort of spread amongst the empire. And the East India Company took advantage of that and eventually took control of it in 1849 from their boy king at that time.
So I understand, Meera, there was quite a bit of unrest amongst the population in those early years of the 20th century. So what were the main gripes with the way that the British administration was running the region, I guess, aside from the fact that independence had been lost?
Just to give you a context of what was going on in the area, this was a fairly rich, prosperous, fertile land area. In 1900, there was the Punjab Land Alienation Act that had been passed, which restricted the way in which land could be inherited between the Punjabi farmers. In 1906, a colonization bill was passed, which allowed for private land to be taken over by the government if there were no legitimate heirs. And, when I say legitimate heirs, it was a fairly loose term. So any kind of excuse, land was being taken over. So there was already a lot of discontent at that point. And these two acts led to a much greater unrest, dissatisfaction, discontent amongst both the elite and the lower class farmers, largely farming population in that region. And this was, of course, over and above the general tone of humiliation that was part of the discourse of the empire.
Now, I understand there was some quite serious unrest in 1907. What happened then?
So there was a mutiny. Bengal had just been partitioned. And in 1907, there was a mutiny by the Jat infantry, who sort of joined hands with their Bengali brothers and mutinied. This was quelled very quickly. It was suppressed very quickly. But at that moment, there was an awareness, a very serious awareness that unrest and mutinies, rebellions could take place at any point. So all these responses that we see in the 20th century all are with reference to the 1857 mutiny, which is just about 50 years before the period we are talking about, and has scarred the British rule in a very serious way. So any kind of unrest, rebellion, is seen as a potential mutiny.
I've got Dr. Meera Ashar with me, Director of the Australian National University South Asia Research Institute. You're learning tonight about the Jallianwala Bagh massacre, which took place in 1919. So by the time World War One arrived, Meera, Punjab contributed very heavily, and reading the figures, really disproportionately to troop numbers to fight in World War One. How many went to help the British Empire?
Just to contextualize this, in World War One, the British Army was about 250,000 troops, and the Indian Army, or the British Indian Army, which, as you mentioned, had a disproportionately large number of troops from the Punjab, was over 1 million. So 1 million troops were sent as part of a volunteer army to serve as part of the World War One efforts.
So, 250,000 actual British soldiers in the British Army and more than 1 million Indian soldiers.
That's right. So by the end of the First World War, with all the kind of efforts and volunteering calls, the British Army had reached about 400,000 by the end of the war, and the British Indian Army was over 1 million.
That's incredible. What an incredible figure.
Absolutely. And this was a population that had no real stake in the war at all.
And now let's just clarify before we go much further, Meera, that we will talk about the British Indian Army quite a lot. Mm-hmm. And it is separate to the British Army. What was the distinction?
So the British Indian Army, or it's sometimes just called the Indian Army, was comprised largely of Indian troops. Not Indian officers, but the soldiers on foot, the soldiers sort of serving at the subaltern ranks, were largely Indian.
World War One ended up being at a time when anti-Raj sentiment was running high, and Punjab ended up being an area where there was quite a bit of political activity as the push towards Indian independence really took off. For example, there was a plan in 1915 for a pan-Indian mutiny, which was in the Indian Army. Tell me about that plan, because this is something else, of course, that's scarring the British terribly.
Absolutely. So yes and no. That on the one hand, at the beginning of the war, from even before the World War began around 1910, and so revolutionary activity or the revolutionary strand of anti-colonial movement was very active, and they continued to be active till the end of the Second War. So that was sort of one kind of movement, independence movement, that ran almost parallel to the Gandhian movement or the Indian National Congress, a civil disobedience movement. And the civil disobedience movement was very much helping the British war effort. So, and this is again something that is not often talked about, but Gandhi was one of the sort of very active recruiters for the British Indian Army. And, he did this all in good faith, saying, we need to help the empire, we as subjects of the empire need to help in the war efforts. And he went around actually recruiting people and believing that as subjects of the empire, Indians were obliged to help out. So that was kind of one strand. But the revolutionaries, who you speak about, they were very active, and they did not fall in line, or they did not take the path that Gandhi did and the Indian National Congress did, but they rather felt that this was the time to kind of strike and form alliances to cripple the empire or to overthrow the empire. There were expatriate groups such as the Berlin Committee and the Ghadar Party, along with Indian revolutionaries, who had planned a sort of unified general uprising on 21st February 1915, which later comes to be known as the Ghadar Conspiracy. Now, this was a heavily monitored group, and there were intelligence files on all these people who were active in this group. The Punjab CID caught wind of it, and the mutinies or the rebellions that were planned were quelled fairly quickly.
So, but this is another example that the British are seeing, that here, you know, people in India are trying to rise up against us while we're busy trying to fight this war, is the way they would have seen that. And there, I know there were some other perceived threats to British rule at that time. You know, what did the British do about all of this?
Well, they reacted very brutally. And so, you know, when you talk of perceived threats, indeed, all these perceived threats, as I mentioned, were seen through the specter of the 1857 rebellion, the memory of which continued to haunt the British, and for which at every point retribution was massive.
In 1915, after we've had this threatened uprising during World War I, there's something called the Defence of India Act, which was introduced. What did powers did that give the British?
That's right. The Defence of India Act granted the government very wide-ranging powers. And again, this is something that is not uncommon in war times, which is why it was accepted in a way by certain factions of the Indian anti-colonial movement, which put massive restrictions on press, on free speech, and allowed for sort of trials detainment during wartime.
You're on This Week in History in Nightlife on this Sunday night. We're talking about, you might know it as the Amritsar Massacre or the Jallianwala Bagh Massacre, which took place in the city of Amritsar in 1919 in India. And my guest is Associate Professor Meera Shah, Director of the Australian National University's South Asia Research Institute. So, Meera, we've got the Defence of India Act, and then after World War I, the British introduced something else. This is called the Rowlatt Act. So they felt the need to continue putting measures in place to crack down on independence movements in India, didn't they?
Absolutely. So it was understood, or at least there was sort of a wide understanding, that the Defence of India Act would be lifted once the war ended as a reward for all the troops that were sent.
The million troops that had been sent, yeah.
Absolutely. Particularly members of the Congress and others were expecting some kind of concessions or rewards. But what they found, what they got, was the Rowlatt Act, which gave stricter control to freedom of speech, of press, which allowed for arrests without warrants or, you know, detainment without trials. Basically, the expulsion of most things that we would consider part of rule of law. This was sort of seen as a big betrayal by the British government when, in fact, what was expected was certain concessions. And
so instead of rewards, the net is tightening on the kinds of freedoms that were allowed. Now, I know, Meera, that unrest was particularly high in Bengal and the Punjab. Why did those areas seem to be more febrile than other parts of India?
Right. So the Bengal had just been partitioned into East and West Bengal, which had created much unrest as well. Punjab, where dissatisfaction with the colonial government had been growing, was also the seat of a lot of revolutionary activity. So it's not that these two were more febrile, but the kind of unrest that you see, particularly in Punjab, was one that was particularly frightening for the British Empire.
And what kind of unrest was there? What, you know, if you were the British and you were wandering around, what would you see as examples of this unrest?
So there was disruption of railway services, there was attacks on banks, there were attacks on cutting of telecommunication lines, you know, basically anything that would cripple the empire. So it was not necessarily an armed attack or a volatile riot, but they were not cooperating or working with the British government the way in which the Indian National Congress and the Gandhi Satyagraha movement was. So these were sort of unknown entities and quite terrifying for the British.
So then in the lead up to the massacre, so this is on April 13, there were a couple of other events which took place, which fed into these feelings, which were running very high. There was a protest at the house of Miles Irving, who was then the deputy commissioner of Amritsar. That happened on April the 10th. So what happened at that protest?
You know, the reason why these protests were taking place, not just in Punjab, but elsewhere in the country as well, was in response to the Rawal attack. So Gandhi had called for, you know, hartals or strikes, and you know, these were all meant to be and were in most part peaceful strikes, part of the Satyagraha non-cooperation movement as protest against the Rawal attack. And so in Punjab as well, there were strikes that were called for by local leaders. Gandhi was meant to be traveling to Punjab, you know, early April, as well as two other leaders who were both Gandhians, who were, you know, pacifists, who were part of the nonviolence movement, Doctors Satyapal and Kichru. And these were two beloved leaders of, you know, Punjab. They were both arrested on the 10th of April or before the 10th of April. But again, nothing was known. There was sort of an information void, as it were. With sort of past experience of the British reaction to protests, there was also a fear that, you know, these leaders were not just detained, but shot, or, you know, Gandhi was stopped, or again, there were rumors that he had been shot or jailed. Nobody knew what was going on. And so a group of protesters gathered outside Commissioner Irving's house, demanding that their two leaders, Satyapal and Kichru, be released, or at least demanding what had happened to them. So that was those were the protesters who found themselves outside Miles Irving's house.
And I understand several protesters then were shot by the British military.
Commissioner Irving had on that same morning attested that Punjab was largely peaceful, Amritsar was peaceful, that his deputy commissioner did not agree with that assessment. But when protesters turned up, they were not just beaten with lathis, but they were with batons, but they were also shot at, and several died or were killed as part of that shooting. This meant that an already tense mob of people, amongst whom rumors have been spreading of what was to happen to them, what had happened to their leaders, turned violent.
And so I understand there was sort of a tit for tat, really. I think several British people were then killed, a couple of British women as well. And then the next day, the 11th of April, Marcella Sherwood, who was an elderly English missionary, was assaulted. What happened to her?
Marcella Sherwood, as part of the evacuation orders that had come in for British women and children, was cycling along one of the narrow laneways of Amritsar and was attacked by a group of young boys. I think it was six boys who attacked her. She was beaten up. She was beaten with slippers, and she was then rescued by a group of Indians. But this attack on Marcella Sherwood was something that rang a fear amongst the British population.
And there's this example that happens where the punishment for this assault was meted out to every man who lived on that particular street in a particularly humiliating way as well. What happened?
It has been characterized as retribution, or, you know, even indiscriminate retribution. But, you know, retribution is usually sort of against perpetrators of the crime. But this was a punishment that was meted out to the largest civilian population that was then beaten, humiliated, starved. And there was a very poignant sort of crawl order given for, you know, anyone who wanted to pass through that street, any native who wanted to pass through that street. They had to crawl the length of that narrow street.
They had to
including
crawl.
People who lived there.
They had to crawl through the street.
They had to crawl through the street. And they were made to crawl through the street, you know, with officers posted there who would beat up people, including elderly people who lived on the street and had no option but to go to that street.
Yeah. And the local Brigadier General Reginald Dyer, who is really going to come more into things when we get to the actual massacre, this is astounding. He had to explain why he'd made the men crawl. And he said, "Some Indians crawl face downwards in front of their gods. I wanted them to know a British woman is as sacred as a Hindu god, and therefore they have to crawl in front of her too." That's just, well, that's going to whip up the crowd, isn't it?
That's right. And this is something that we are going to see about Dyer, he believed in, you know, retribution. He believed in striking terror. And that is going to be the way in which he's going to deal with everything that happens in the next few days and later. And again, this is not just Dyer him, as an individual, but this is part of the larger logic of colonial violence, that it is not a deterrent, it is not a punishment, but it is a creation of psychological and physical terror.
Associate Professor Meera Ashar is here, Director of the ANU South Asia Research Institute. We're talking about the Amritsar massacre. So after all of this, the British rulers decided to put Punjab, the whole place, under martial law. Was that what then drove this big protest, which was called for the Jallianwala Bagh on the 13th of April?
So the protest was always planned. It was part of the protest against the Rowlatt. But the martial law, of course, exasperated that. And a prayer meeting was called on the 13th of April at Jallianwala Bagh.
And so what happened on the day then, Meera? Talk us through it.
So, we'll start in the morning when General Dyer disseminated a notice, and the method of dissemination is worth noting as well. It was sort of a drum roll by a soldier of the British Indian Army, who most civilians would have avoided anyway, but an individual sort of going around saying, here is this notice of a curfew, of people not being allowed to gather in groups of more than four or maybe five. And it's very likely that most people didn't hear this notice at all. You've been to Amritsar. We are talking of a very bustling, boisterous, loud city where it is very, very likely that the notice of the curfew was not heard by most people. And even with those who heard it, they ignored it or didn't quite understand what the entire content.
But Dyer thinks, doesn't he, that he's banned all public gatherings of more than five people. So to him, that is law. No more than five people must get together as of right
now. Yeah. Absolutely. He feels he's done his job. He's given a warning. Even if, that has been received or recognized, he felt he had done enough to warn people.
Yeah. So people started gathering, Meera. At what point did the British Indian Army turn up?
So this was also the time of the celebration of Baisakhi, the harvest festival, which is very, very important in Punjab. It's a time of celebration, of, getting together with family, friends, of public fairs. So there was a cattle fair, a horse fair. So all kinds of people were in Amritsar at the time. And apart from the people who had turned up for this protest meeting, this prayer meeting, there were also people who had wandered in to Jallianwala Bagh, who were just there in Amritsar, who had come to the Golden Temple, that's less than 10 minutes away from the Jallianwala Bagh. There were families who just sauntered in or wandered in. For Dyer, this is it for him. He feels he has told people not to gather, and here they are. He said about 6,000 people, but we know from later estimates that it was about 15,000 to 25,000 people who were there at Jallianwala Bagh before Dyer and his troops rolled up there.
So when they rolled up, if you can explain the layout of the garden to us, because it's basically like a walled garden, is it? So it's not somewhere that people can easily leave. You have to get your way out through the specific entrances.
That's right. So Amritsar itself is, full of narrow alleyways. And this garden, and you know, garden doesn't really describe this place. It's kind of this very dusty, large stadium, if you want, like as large as a cricket stadium, with high walls, 10 feet walls around it. There's one main entrance, which is slightly larger than the five other entrances, which are usually kept locked. And Dyer and his troops, 50 troops, turn up there and block that slightly larger entrance while there are about 15 to 25,000 people gathered.
Now, they've brought a lot of force with them, Mira. Do they say, get out of here, we're going to start shooting? Or how does it all unfold?
Dyer, in fact, intended to bring two cars with machine guns. But, you know, they couldn't get through those narrow roadways, so he had to leave them behind. But he comes there with 50 troops armed with rifles, and they all gather there, blocking the one exit or entrance. And within 30 seconds, by his own account, they start shooting. There's no warning given. You know, Dyer feels he's given that warning in the morning, by telling people not to gather, but they just start shooting within 30 seconds of arriving there.
Mary, with the limited entrances and exits, as you've described, people must have basically just been trapped there.
Absolutely, absolutely. It was, you know, like fish in a barrel. They couldn't leave because Dyer and his men were blocking the one exit, and there were walls, high walls there. So people were trying to climb over them, also trying to get out of some of the sort of really small exits, trampling over each other. And basically they had nowhere to go. They did not know what was happening. And the shooting continues for 10 minutes, you know, round after round. And in between, his troops keep looking to him, and he says, reload, shoot, reload, shoot. And people are trying to escape, to jump over each other. Some few jump into the well. They have nowhere to go, basically.
And Mira, is this the Indian army? Are these Indians shooting Indians, or are these British officials and soldiers shooting Indians?
No, this is the British Indian Army, largely with sort of Gurkha and Baluchi troops.
Goodness me, what must those people have thought? As you know, they're just being shot on for, I guess, what was no discernible reason. So the shooting goes on. What is it? Is it about 10 minutes?
It is about 10 minutes. It goes on for 10 minutes. And that's, you know, as shootings go, that's a very long time. And they keep shooting round after round. And we know the number of rounds they shot, 1,650 rounds.
So I mentioned that there are widely varying estimates about the numbers of deaths and casualties from this 10 minutes. Which numbers are thought to be closest, Mira?
I mean, Dyer, when he made no attempt to calculate or count the number of fatalities or casualties. The next day he said there were about 200 to 300, but later estimates were given of 300 and I think 79. But the Indian National Congress had their own sort of committee and survey done, and they estimated it was closer to 1,500 people.
Me. And what was Amritsar like in the hours and the days after this had happened? I mean, how incredibly shocking for the city.
So again, and you know, before we move on, the people who were killed were not just those who were shot by Dyer's troops, but they were, after that 10 minute of shooting, you know, Dyer and his troops left, leaving people bleeding there. The curfew is still on. No medical help was provided, and no one could seek medical help because there was a curfew on. A lot of fatalities were people who had probably died of injuries, bleeding out, or being even trampled upon in that large crowd.
So just an awful, awful story. So Mira, Dyer, was he called to account for his actions?
Yes and no. There was an inquiry commission that was set up, which had both British and Indian members on it. Dyer refused counsel, and he sort of attended the inquiry alone. And his His responses in that during that Hunter inquiry were at one level shocking and another level again not. And I'll talk a little bit about this. As much as people would like to believe, he was not punished. He was not even fired. He was asked to go on a long leave. In England, he had a hero's welcome. There were sort of fundraising efforts for him, and over £26,000 were collected. So, he was very much seen as a hero.
But what did he have to say to the commission, which was saying to him, why did you shoot all of these people?
One of the things he said, and you asked me this earlier, did he give any orders to disperse the crowd? So his intention was not to disperse the crowd. In fact, he says during the Hunter inquiry, he says, I could have dispersed the crowd without shooting a single bullet. But that's not what he wanted to do. He didn't want to disperse the crowd. He wanted to send a message. He wanted to strike terror. That is what he did. That is what he said he wanted to do. And that is what he did. And he said there was no undue severity. And I'm quoting from him. There was no undue severity. And that he had to break the morale of the rebels.
I understand, though, when the news did get back to Britain, as you're saying, some people saw Dyer as a hero. Others thought it was absolutely horrific. Winston Churchill himself was one of those who thought this was a terrible act.
Churchill it's an interesting case because, Churchill was a man with absolutely no conscience in with regards to the empire. And he did condemn it. And, he says this was an episode without precedent or parallel in the history of British Empire, and it was stands in singular and sinister isolation. So what Churchill does is present this horrible massacre as a one-off lapse of the empire, which it was not. We know as historians and scholars of empire that this was par course of colonial violence. And in condemning it as this kind of isolated, horrific incident, what Churchill does, as so many others do, is to present it as a singular lapse, rather than recognize that it was endemic of colonial violence.
How did the massacre, obviously the people of Amritsar would have been completely traumatized by what had happened, but how did the massacre then, Meera, move the dial in India in terms of how Indian people felt and thought about the British and their presence there?
As I mentioned earlier, with the First World War and this large volunteer army that India has sent at part of the war efforts, there was still at least one part of the Indian anti-colonial movement that believed they could work with the British Empire, that they could gain their independence bit by bit, they could work with the British officials and so on. After the news of the Jallianwala Bagh massacre reached, and it did not reach immediately because the British were very good at curtailing information, it took almost months, before there was anything clearly known, I think even the moderates amongst the Indian anti-colonialists felt that, now they couldn't really work with the British Empire. So Rabindranath Tagore, who was Sir Rabindranath, he was knighted, he returned his knighthood and sort of spoke very eloquently and openly about how this signifies or this sort of is representative of the horrors of the empire. And there's no working with that it has to end.
I mentioned at the start, Meera, that Britain has never formally apologised for the massacre, but has a quote-unquote expressed regret. That's been a long-running sore point, hasn't it?
Yeah, and it continues to sort of speak of this as ranging from, General Dyer's individual lapse of judgment to kind of a regrettable incident in the long colonial rule. There has been many sort of justifications, excuses, regrets expressed, but there has never been an apology. There has also not been a recognition that this was not a singular event.
How is the event remembered in Amritsar today?
It is memorialized. It is seen as emblematic of the British rule in India. It is a place of, where those who were killed in Jallianwala Bagh are spoken of as martyrs. That's become, in some sense, a place of pilgrimage.
Meera, thanks so much for being on Nightlife in This Week in History tonight and just explaining what happened at the Amritsar massacre in 1919.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.